There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. When you hear the word museum, there's a good chance you picture paintings hanging on a wall. But art museums make up only 4.5% of American museums. More than half of our museums fall into the history category. And if you combine all of the children's museums, zoos, aquariums, and botanical gardens across the country, it's still less than 5%. Science and technology museums barely scratch 1%, but host millions of annual visitors. We recently traveled to Dallas to visit the Perot Museum of Nature and Science and get a look at how these places work from the inside out, including a tour of Origins, the Perot's first exhibition created in-house. If you can get to Dallas soon, don't miss it. The show runs through March 22nd. Here's our conversation with Becca Pisciotto, archaeologist and director of the museum's Center for the Exploration of the Human Journey, and the museum's CEO, Linda Silver.
I guess I'd like to begin with the Perot in general, how it came to be. And, you know, it seems like the impact on the city has been pretty immediate. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the origin of the project?
Sure. Well, I think what Dallas did in putting the Perot Museum together is actually something that's very inspirational and other cities should look at as a model. In 2008, Dallas took their old natural history museum, research and collection space, their interactive science museum, at that time called Science Place, and the children's museum, and merged them all together. So they were recognizing back then that there was overlapping audience, there was mission creep, there was overlapping asks to donors as well. And so the idea of housing all of this under one roof came to be, and we opened 7.5 years ago.
Becca, can you talk about the role? I guess I'd like to hear from both of you about what those jobs entail, where their overlap is.
Yeah, so I am the director of one of the centers within the museum.
Okay.
We have three centers of excellence. Mine is the Center for the Exploration of the Human Journey. We also have a center of excellence around gems and minerals and around Arctic paleontology, which is the Alaskan Dinosaurs Research Division of the museum. So I'm responsible for the part that deals with human journey, and that's specifically where the origins
of it comes in. But your background is in archaeology specifically.
Right. Yes.
Which is, you know, obviously a hands-on job. Mm-hmm. How does that kind of work where you're not getting as much time out, you know, digging in caves as you were before? Yeah. You're doing kind of the museum side of it. Do you have to find a balance between those two pursuits?
Absolutely. Doing the field work is a big part of my professional identity. It's what I enjoy doing. And part of my deal here at the museum is that I continue to get that field work. So I maintain an appointment, a research associate appointment at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. And I'm back there 3 times a year to do excavations and participate in research. So that keeps the science that we're showing here at the museum up to date and valid, and it's we're portraying active, ongoing research here with the credibility of having someone who's actually participating in it.
Linda, you have about 350 employees here. Mm-hmm. Has it been that robust since the beginning, and how has the institution grown in terms of knowing what you need? I mean, when you start something, it's very much, you know, you combine these institutions, you're trying to see what this is going to be. I'm sure you need to get in there and have this practical application to understand that. But, you know, talk about where the museum is right now in terms of assets and what you have on hand.
Sure. Well, you mentioned the 350 or so staff. We also have 2,000 volunteers. They make up about 17% of our overall workforce. So that's a critical piece as well. And so for the first few years of the museum, really, it was about operating and understanding what the building would need, where we thought our attendance might shuffle out, and then understanding how we respond to that with staff and programs, et cetera. One of the things that we've done over the course of the last 2.5 years is start to develop areas where we're going to focus our research, these centers of excellence that Becca had indicated earlier, and really start to understand where the Perot Museum can take a lead in the museum field, whether that's nationally or in some cases, as in the Center for the Exploration of the Human Journey, internationally. And then we start to staff around that. So these three centers have all required that we bring in experts with deep knowledge in scientific areas and start to build in that area.
So you're here in downtown Dallas, and there's a lot of museum activity in Dallas, but a lot of it very much is traditional, you know, art museums. Do you feel like you've been welcomed by the museum establishment writ large in Dallas? Do you feel like an outlier because of the topics compared to, you know, art museums or the Sculpture Center or anywhere else?
I think we actually complement each other very, very nicely. And I would say I'm relatively new still to Dallas, but that the leadership of the art museums, as well as other museums and cultural spaces, have been incredibly welcoming. And I think Dallas is at this place right now where you've got leaders of these institutions who want to be very collaborative. And so we'll share information. All of our human resource people get together and have meetings and talk about things that happen that we all need to be responsive to. Our CFOs do the same thing. And so you see a lot of collaboration and conversation in Dallas. And I think that's incredibly healthy for the organizations, even if our program profiles are very different, because our donor profiles are not different and our memberships, for the most part, very much overlap.
Becca, can you talk a little bit about the role the museum plays in citywide education efforts? Working with the school system, you know, how do you see those overlap?
The museum has a robust education division, including teacher professional development. And it's been going on for several years now. Hundreds of teachers have come through the program. And I think it's a tremendous resource for teachers and for students in this area. Museum educators go out to schools. We have the tech truck, that sort of a mobile museum that goes to schools and community events. For people who can't come down to downtown, it's far away from lots of places in Dallas. And, you know, for those kind of short visits where that hour-long drive into downtown is not really your thing. And I think it's a great thing that the museum's sort of getting outside of the box and the physical box that we're in and being out and around in the city. The division I work in, the Center for the Exploration of the Human Journey, I think we've tried to complement some of that work by offering teacher professional development workshops around teaching human evolution and human origin, which is something that is not a particularly common topic to discuss in Texas schools. So giving teachers resources and practice talking about human origins topics within the framework of the TEKS and the Texas state standards.
One of the things that I love to talk to people in the museum world about is the idea that museums should and could be fun. And I think science and nature museums understand this far better than most museums. There's a sense of play that seems inherent to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Is that purposeful? Are you thinking about that all the time, Linda, specifically, in what you're doing?
Absolutely. We think about it all the time. In fact, we have a little tagline. Our engagement team has the big, bold, fun tagline. So as we're developing programs, as we're developing new initiatives, kind of feed it through that filter, because we know that people come here expecting to learn something. So we don't need to necessarily make that point very boldly, but we do need to let them know that while they're here, they're going to have fun and they're going to have time to share experiences with one another. And that's what people seem to really be looking for these days.
Yeah, it seems like from the design of the exhibitions, you know, through the interpretive materials, all of that just seems very cohesive. And I'm sure it takes a ton of time. We're going to talk a little bit about the exhibition Origins that you have right now, which just from the moment you step outside the gallery just has this kind of beautiful presentation. It feels like you're really walking into something momentous. The groundwork that goes into just the physical layout design and production of a show like that, is that multi-years in the making? It seems like it would have to be based on what I saw.
So we're both going to laugh, because the answer is it should be. Yeah. It should be multi-years in the making. And with the Origins exhibition in particular, it was not. It was done at breakneck speed, because we had this small window of time, this small opportunity to bring the real fossils out of South Africa and to house them here to show North Texas and anybody who wants to come and see them before they have to go back to South Africa. So while we would normally take 3 to 5 years to plan something like this, we did it between 18 months from the time I first met Lee Berger till the time we opened this show.
Best laid plans, right?
Right.
Becca, maybe you could talk about what the show is. how it came about. Obviously, it came together quite quickly, but what an amazing opportunity for the museum to host these materials. Can you talk about how it all started?
Sure. Yeah, the Origins exhibit is allows us to display original hominin fossils, so the bones of ancient human relatives, the real bones, not casts or models or replicas, but the real thing, here in the United States, here in Texas. And that's a really unusual event because these hominin fossils don't typically travel outside their country of origin. The last time this really happened was when Lucy did a U.S. tour in 2008, I think that was. But it's so unusual for these things to travel. And Lee Berger, who's the lead scientist for both projects of these fossils, has had a long-time relationship with Dallas. And with the Perot Museum, we came as a research group to give talks here back in 2015, I think, right after these fossils, some of the fossils were found. And just through building that relationship with the museum and with Dallas, this became an opportunity to host these fossils here. Typically, I think these fossils would have gone to one of the coasts, where human origins is more of a topic that people want to see more stuff about. And so it's a really great opportunity to have them here in Dallas, where it's not sort of the usual kind of exhibit that would come through.
You've touched on this a couple of times. Bones and fossils aren't inherently a political or controversial topic, but when you're talking about evolution and you're talking about some of those things, you certainly butt up against some conversations in your community that I'm sure people are having about, you know, what's something they want their children to be exposed to, all these things. How do you prepare for those kind of discussions? I'm sure you had to take it into account when you were dealing with a show like this.
Absolutely. It was an early conversation that we had. We went as far as having crisis control plans. What happens if you have people who are protesting because they don't necessarily accept the evidence for evolution? But we have been very happy in that the majority of our audiences who've shown up to see this exhibition are supportive, do want to have more dialogue, do want to understand more about evolution and our shared human journey and where it's come from and where it might take us. But yes, as an organization, it's something that we pay a lot of attention to early on.
When it comes to fossils and bones, Becca, I'll ask you as an archaeologist, it would be very easy to let them sit in a case and just be dead, you know, the way that they actually are. How do you bring those things to life? Because that's, in some ways, the mission of the entire organization. You know, that and also seems like one of the hardest things to do.
For me, it's as much about bringing the bones to life, being able to tell the story of these, you know, Australopithecus sediba 2 million years ago and what their environment was like, and Homo naledi 300,000 years ago, as it is telling the story about how we make these discoveries and how the science happens. And I think that's what helps bring the bones to life, so to speak. The Origins exhibit is as much about how we know what we know and what we don't yet know as it is about the bones themselves. And I think that's something that really draws people in. Because, yeah, it's a bunch of dead bones sitting in a case. Woo! But the interesting part is, who are the people that are finding the bones? How are we studying them? What kind of questions are they asking? How do we find the answers to those questions? And where can the visitors to the museum, as they grow up to become scientists, contribute to that? Where can they fit into the story?
When you see the timelines, when you're talking about millions of years, to me, it's a daunting in the same way that when you try to fathom the concept of infinity. Mm-hmm. You know, 2 million years, to me, it's almost impossible to understand. How do you bridge those gaps where people may not have any true understanding or relation to that, you know? You're making parallels between humanity, you know, early relatives, all these things, but there's a coldness to numbers, years, and dates, you know, that I guess in some ways to further our previous point, to kind of warm those things up a little bit.
Yeah. Part of it, I think, comes from doing comparisons. How is Australopithecus sediba similar to us? And how are they different? And how is their environment similar to us? We worked with a colleague who's a carnivore fossil specialist. So he doesn't look at the hominins. He looks at the other animals we find around. We worked with him to create these murals that you see in the exhibit that are reconstructions of what we think the environment there looked like. And then we have photographs of what the environment there looks like today and the kinds of animals that are there today. So you can see sort of that change over time and how things have stayed the same and what things have changed.
I loved one of the things about the show, which was the willingness to also say what you don't know. There's no doubt that there's a ton of scholarship and knowledge around the show, but there are moments where you say, you know, we don't know what connects A to B here. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I guess, in some ways, the missing link conversation. But, you know, why is it important to also be kind of upfront about the gaps in your knowledge?
Often when people come to museums, they see something on display, so they think all the work is done. and that's the end of the story. The bones are in the case, yeah. We're done. And that's definitely not the situation, at least with these fossils and really with most things you see. And that we're still doing research. This is active science that's going on. There are 150 or more scientists all over the world who have their careers based around these bones and trying to understand more and more about them. And, you know, the more questions we answer, then that lets us ask more questions. And that's a pretty exciting place to be in. And I think for young people, you know, kids especially that come, that, you know, it's not that we've discovered everything and, you know, now you can be a scientist and do something different. You can join us and you can help us solve some of these other mysteries.
Linda, do you think there's any kind of misconception that science and nature museums are more geared towards children?
I think there are, absolutely, and it is one thing that we struggle with, and purposely then create adult programs or experiences that are 21 and over, for example.
Cocktails and whatnot.
Exactly, yeah. To be able to bring those audiences in, because I think for the most part, people don't give up that curiosity that you have when you're an 8-year-old and you look up at a T-Rex. You can still have that same sense of awe and curiosity when you're 38. And what's interesting about the Perot is, unlike many of our peers in the field, we actually have a strong segment of our audience that comes without children. And so that's something that we continue to build on. But I believe that the misperception is indeed out there and persists, unfortunately.
Are there any other things that you think people don't quite understand about the museum and what it is? You know, like, what are some of the things that you're constantly kind of having to, you know, say, no, actually, it's this. Are there any, you know, if you had kind of a frequently asked questions, but it was more of a frequently corrected questions, you know, what are some of the things people don't quite understand about
it's
the museum?
A really good question. I think that a lot of times, especially with younger children, the idea of what's real versus not real is something that's very interesting. So if you look at taxidermied animals or you look at fossils, are they real? Absolutely, they're real, but they're not alive anymore. And so understanding that differentiation for our youngest audience is something that, you know, we get asked all the time, is it real? I would say, though, our biggest challenge is getting to those folks who don't come to the museum because their perception might be that we're not a place for them. And whether that's triggered by the architecture of the building, as we find out in some places, whether it's content and certain audiences feeling that they don't already know enough to come in to a place that talks about science is another. And frankly, that's where we're focusing more and more of our attention, is who's not coming and asking the question why.
That's a great point in the sense of diversity of audience. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're always looking at the makeup of your audience, how you can make it more broad. What kind of efforts can you actually do to kind of change the makeup of your audience?
Right. Well, one of the things that we would love to do is ensure that our audience is reflective of the larger DFW area. And so we know that we have certain segments of the population that we really have to reach out to. Some of that is answered through opportunities like our Community Partners Program that allows people who are on federal or state assistance to come into the museum for $1. So opening access for those who might have financial barriers for coming here. But it tends that there are more social barriers to coming here than there are financial. And so doing things, as you noted, downstairs in the hall, in the Origins exhibition, starting to ensure that all of our label copy is not just in English, but is bilingual in English and Spanish in a part of the country where
Spanish
is. Is that
a more recent effort? Is that something?
It is. Yeah. When I got here 2 years ago, we had 0% of our text in Spanish. It was 100% in English. We're now at about 22% with a commitment to ensure that we get to 100% going forward. One other thing is ensuring that as we hire, we're hiring audiences that might not traditionally have grown up coming to museums, because people like to see others like themselves when they're coming into spaces like this. It just makes it more welcoming. So it's language, it's finances, it's the hiring practices of the organization. And it's a commitment to continually asking that question, continually doing surveys and research in this area, and then responding to it.
Yeah. It's also a representation of who we're profiling in the museum, who's showing up on the panels, you know, in the exhibits themselves. And are we reaching gender parity with the scientists we're showing? Are we showing scientists of color? Are we showing people that look like the diverse community in which we live as being scientists because they are? And so if you can see yourself in the museum, then I think you'd be often more likely to want to come and participate in the activities of the museum.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Replicas. Sometimes we want to show you something, but the original object is far too fragile or too valuable or both. That's where Replicas come in. Most of the time, you won't even know the difference, or at least we hope you won't. And if we're being totally honest here, and with you, dear listener, we're always being totally honest, sometimes we simply don't trust you to be that close to the real thing. It's not personal, but accidents happen. And that's the best part about Replicas. If someone, not you of course, but if someone were to damage an object, we could just order another one. This ad was paid for in part by Replica Review magazine. More information on Replica Review on the internet. Probably. Somewhere.
You were making a really interesting point earlier about the idea of, you know, what's real and what's not. I've been to so many science museums that do have replicas and facsimiles of things. And I wonder, you know, if people walk by a case of fossils and they don't quite realize that, but you don't want to have a giant sign that says, hey, this is real with two giant neon arrows pointing at it. Is that a challenge, Becca, in some of the things you do?
It is a challenge, especially in the Origins exhibit. People are accustomed to seeing replicas. If you go on to the fourth floor and look at our dinosaurs, it's not immediately clear which one of those are casts and which ones are original fossils. And so coming down into Origins and seeing those bones, I think a lot of people do assume that they are replicas. And when they're told or when they read the signs that say that these are original fossils, then I think their relationship with them and their experience in the exhibit changes. We have a colleague here at the museum, a cultural anthropologist, who's doing some research about that related to the Origins exhibit and how do audiences react differently when they understand that the bones are real, so to speak, versus being a copy of something.
And I would jump in and say that that's one of the real values of museums, right? Is that we can show you the real things. You can have access to the real things.
Yeah, and maybe sometimes in a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. When is anyone ever going to get a chance to see these again? We were talking earlier about the idea that, you know, museums like this are certainly not just for children, but you get a ton of kids through here. I do wonder about the gender split, because it does seem like even in 2020, there's still very much a kind of boys like science, boys like dinosaurs. You know, it doesn't seem to fully be equitable in that regard. Do you make different efforts to try to reach both boys and girls in different ways, or do you have more of a blanket outreach?
I think that we've been more conscientious about looking at them and what might draw them into our programming in different ways. Becca was alluding earlier that if you can't see yourself in a role in a museum, you're not necessarily going to think about it as a future career choice. And one of the things that we've moved to in this last year is ensuring that when you do see scientists down on the floor in terms of our label copy, 50% are female. And we're working more and more towards ensuring that we also show scientists of color. And we do create specialized programs for girls where we think that there are entryways to them, whether that's through partnerships with Girl Scouts and other groups that are out there serving girls in STEM, or whether it's just our own team on the floor, you know, noticing what it is that girls will sign up for more than boys. There are also ways that we do exhibit design differently for girls and boys. So it's really, you know, some things are very simple. If you have an interactive exhibition where two people can sit down, girls are much more likely to use that than if you have an interactive exhibit where one person can sit down. Just boys and girls behave differently in spaces like this. So we're very conscientious of it. And we feel we have a very strong commitment to ensuring inclusivity in STEM.
Yeah. You know, we all have you know, the spreadsheets that we get after a show that has the attendance totals, and it may have the tickets sold, and you have a bottom line of how much revenue the show made. But to me, that's never a true indicator of whether it was a hit or not. There's kind of this intangible concept of buzz or people talking about something. I would put this at you both. Maybe Becca, you could start by, you know, how do you measure something here as a success or not?
I think I personally would measure success a little bit differently than my colleagues here at the museum who work in finance. You know, I was down in Origins at an event a couple weeks ago, and we have some life-size cutouts of some of my colleagues who work underground with me in the cave. And there was a little girl who posed next to these life-size cutouts and said to her dad, "Dad, take my picture. I want to be like them." Okay.
That's all of the stress and heartache for Origins,
you know, we've succeeded,
yes.
Right? If what we're doing in the exhibit is inspiring the people that come, whether they're young people, inspiring them to think about science as a career, or even just be more interested in science in school, or whether they're, you know, the adults that are coming and learning something new and sparking some curiosity in adults and that sort of wonder in the world, then I think we're being successful. All the marketing and all the finance, somebody else can worry about that.
Yeah, there you go.
I worry about that. So I'll, you know, just as a comparison, our last big traveling exhibition was Legos. So if you look at it from a finance standpoint and a numbers standpoint, it blew everything away. Absolutely fabulous. Our guests had a wonderful time. You know, it was a fun exhibition. It doesn't necessarily, though, do anything to raise our profile as a serious museum amongst our peers or in the field. And so I think of opportunities like Origins that help us to do that. So it's raising the credibility, the visibility of the pro and our reputation, again, not just nationally, but globally.
King Tut. King Tut. Now, when he was a young man, he never thought he'd see.
On April 28, 1978, Steve Martin released the novelty song King Tut. He teased it a week earlier with an appearance on Saturday Night Live. The song was written in response to the blockbuster Treasures of Tutankhamun exhibition that traveled to seven cities across America from 1976 to 1979. The exhibition was organized by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Nearly 8 million people saw the show in the U.S. leg alone. The song sold over 1 million copies, reaching number 17 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. When the exhibition was on view at the Field Museum, the song was number one for four straight weeks on Chicago's WLS-AM radio. Nearly 40 years later, in 2017, humanities students at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, protested the inclusion of the Saturday Night Live performance in their coursework, calling the video an example of cultural appropriation while demanding its removal.
He gave his life for tourism.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.